So we'll go through the material here and see how far we get. I don't think we'll get through all of it. What we're going to be looking at is Jesus' last days, his arrest and trial is what we're looking at. And so we're primarily going to be focused on the arrest and the days immediately before that and seek to try to understand them. So in the handout, I have most of the scriptures I wrote down some scriptures, so I'm going to read some scriptures because they lay out some things, and we'll ask a question, and then we'll come back to the questions. We're not going to answer them right away. We'll come back to answer the first few questions. So we'll begin, today what we're going to be examining is during Jesus' last days, what happened, why did it happen, and who was primarily responsible. Now, as you look at Jesus' last days, to really fundamentally understand what unfolds, you need quite a bit of background. Yeah, but we don't have time to go through all the background. So I'll try to fill in a little bit of it as we go. And what you have is, there came a point in time, like I indicated in the Sabbath thought, that the Romans began to rule in Judea. And after the son of Herod botched it, as far as the Romans were concerned, they removed him, sent him to southern France, and they took over to rule the province. And so the Romans sent in a governor to rule the province. You know, Pilate was one of those. And the high priest was then the Jewish person of Jewish background, that was the chief administrative officer. So basically the Romans wanted just a few things in their provinces. One was they wanted stability, they wanted order, and they wanted no trouble. And the responsibility of the Jewish administration was to make sure that happened. And the person that was in charge of the administration was the high priest. And he had certain people that were priests and leading nobles, and they were the chief administrative people in the country. And they made up, I'm not going to go through all the details of why this was, but what you found was what you would call a little Sanhedrin. All right? It was made up of fewer people. And they play an important part in this, and so when we discuss them, you'll say, well, I think he mentioned that. And then there's the great Sanhedrin, which was made up of Pharisees and Sadducees and a larger group of, it was a larger body. But you have a smaller one that's involved in this as well. So when I start talking about this, hopefully you'll understand. But the Romans wanted stability. They wanted order. They wanted no insurrections, no stirring the pot at all. And the high priest and his administrative body, they were responsible for that. And what happens if you botched it? What happened with the Herod's son? There were uprisings in various places. He didn't handle it well. Out he goes. So we'll see a little bit of this as we go through, because the Jewish leadership is well aware of this potential of them losing their position, and that they don't want to lose it. So let's begin in Mark chapter 14, verses 43 through 50. We're not going to read all the verses. We're going to read verse 43, basically. It says, "And immediately while he was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude with swords and clubs," or staves, as it says in the King James Version, "came from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders." So it says that this group of individuals was brought by Judas, and they had swords and staves. So what's the significance of that? We're not going to answer that. We're just going to ask the question at this point. We'll come back to it. Now, if you go down a little further to they forsook him and fled. And then you have another thing that is brought out in John chapter 18, verse 2. It says, "And Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples." This is John 18, verse 2. We're down to verse 3. "Then Judas, having received a detachment of troops, soldiers, and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that would come upon him, went forward and said to them, 'Whom are you seeking?' They said, 'Jesus of Nazareth.'" And then we're going to go over to Luke chapter 22, verses 52 and 53. "Then Jesus said to the chief priest, captains of the temple, and elders who had come to him, 'Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you daily in the temple, you did not try to seize me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness.'" And so we'll talk about the word, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs?" So that's a significant question, which we'll look at here briefly. So when you consider the passages above, who is primarily responsible for Christ's arrest? Who is primarily responsible for Christ's arrest? Judas? Judas isn't responsible. Yes, Rich? Hold on. Raise your hand.
There we go. I would say the chief priests were responsible because they're the ones that goaded Judas to turn Christ in so that they could follow through with arresting him.
Okay. So, anybody else? Now, as you look at Luke's account, we are told specifically the chief priest and captains of the temple. All right, in Luke's account, which we read. And what group are we talking about? As Mr. Schultz said, the chief priests and captains of the temple. Who are they? They are a particular group called the small Sanhedrin. And I could use another word for that, but I'm not going to confuse you. Just figure the small Sanhedrin is who it talks about. This is the chief priest and that assists the high priest. So they're administrative priest, and they assist the high priest. The captains of the temple was a place dominated by the priests, not the Pharisees. They were Sadducees. They were priests. So you have the Sadducean leadership made up this small Sanhedrin, this small leadership group, the little Sanhedrin. And we have support for this identification in John's account, where it says, "Judas, having received a band of soldiers and officers." When you look at that, it's somewhat ambiguous. We might ask, are these Jewish soldiers or Jewish officers? Is this just a Jewish temple guard that he has received? Is that what it's talked about? And this is clarified a little further down in John chapter 18, verse 12. John chapter 18, verse 12. There it says, "Then the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him." And it talks about the detachment of troops, and then it talks about the captain and the officers of the Jews. So it's talking about two different groups. A discrimination is being made. And the discrimination is between the Jewish officers and the band and the chief captains. If you want to take the time to look through Robertson's, I believe it is, Harmony of the Gospel, there's a footnote, and it explains what the technical Greek words are. And they refer to a Roman band, a band of Roman soldiers with a Roman centurion in charge. So you had Jewish troops that were overseen by the high priest and his assistants, and you also had some Roman troops that came out there. So you had two different groups, and it distinguishes between the two if you really look at the wording. Both a Jewish leadership group and a Roman band of soldiers under the command of a Roman officer. So you have both of them involved in Jesus' arrest. And this also reinforces the identification as to who is responsible for the arrest. Because under the Roman system of government, what group was charged with the day-to-day administration of dealing with the people? Was it the great Sanhedrin or the little Sanhedrin? You don't know. It was the little Sanhedrin. It was their responsibility to oversee the administration. They were the ones directly responsible to the Romans. So if there was a problem, the Romans came to the high priest and his administrative assistants and said, "What's up, fellas? Why are we having this trouble?" All right, so they would have to deal with the Romans directly. The high priest and his closest associates were the ones charged with the day-to-day Roman policy in Palestine. The Roman governor made the policy, but it was the high priest and his associates that had the responsibility for carrying it out. So the Jewish leadership in the form of the Sadducean-dominated little Sanhedrin was the one that had committed to them Roman soldiers, no auxiliaries, but Roman soldiers to make a show of force when they had to do so. And that's what the secular sources tell us. And it's confirmed here in the Gospels that we have Roman military unit, not just a purely Jewish one. So you have Roman troops and Jewish troops here involved in the arrest of Jesus Christ. So they sent the Roman troops to say, "We really mean business here. We're taking this very seriously, and we're going to arrest this man." So, did anybody discover what is the significance of the use of the term robber? What is the, when he uses the term robber, what's Christ referring to? Yes? Hold on.
Okay, in Matthew 21:13, when he overturned the tables in the temple, he told them that they had made the temple a den of robbers. So maybe he was saying, "Are you saying that now I'm the robber?"
Okay, that's how you could interpret it. But there's more to the story. Anybody else? Okay, this is again where you need to. And my goal here isn't to stump you. My goal is to just give you information, share this with you, and do it in a kind of question-answer way. When the term robber, as Jesus said, "Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs?" And robber was a term used for a political group in Palestine at the time. So you had two political groups. One of them was known as the Herodians, and robber is not associated with the Herodians. The term robber is associated with the group the Zealots. It's associated with the group the Zealots. Do any of you remember anybody that was associated with Christ that was a Zealot? That was part of this political party? Anybody? Simon the Zealot. So he had been associated with the Zealots at one time. So the word robber in the political spectrum of the majority of the people, they weren't associated with the Zealots or the Herodians. Most people were in the middle, and they weren't really involved with all of that. And they might have sympathy with one group over another, but they weren't generally involved. Josephus, writing under the patronage of the Roman imperial family, had to soft-pedal certain issues, and Joseph calls this group Sicari in Latin, and Sicarius means dagger man. Dagger man is a term applied in the decades immediately preceding the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. To an extremist splinter group of the Jewish zealots who fought the Roman occupation of Judea in an attempt to expel the Romans. So he paints them in a negative light, and they needed funding. So how do you think that they funded their efforts? By robbing. Okay, they were robbers. That's why they were referred to as robbers. So it's a euphemistic term which is used in the Gospels to describe them, that term, robbers. And so they would rob people, they would extort money from the rich, and it doesn't necessarily mean thief, nor does the term thief in one of the Gospels necessarily mean thief. It means these individuals who were against Rome and seeking to overthrow them, and they used various methods to come up with the money. The Zealots advocated the violent overthrow of the Romans in order to establish independent Jewish rule. And this party is the one who eventually precipitated the rebellion against Rome that took place between 66 and 70 A.D. And that really didn't work out so well for them. They may have been zealous, but they were zealously killed by the Romans. And as I said, the other major group, probably smaller in numbers, were the Herodians, and we're not going to talk about them this year either. Christ said, as they came out to arrest him, he said, "When I was with you daily in the temple, you did not try to seize me." And this is also important because it again goes along with identifying the people who are instigating the arrest. And Jesus is saying, you know, did you come out against me as a robber? And he's saying, you know, you're coming out to arrest me like I'm a zealot? You've heard me speak in the temple. You know what I said. I've not advocated the overthrow of Rome. He never did advocate that. And he said, and this is where swords and staves comes in. Anybody have a answer to that one? Why does he bring that point up? Rich?
I think they came out because they thought they were going to have a fight, and that they were prepared because they thought Christ's disciples would fight back and they would take them violently. Also, they did it at night and they thought they could kill them at night or take them away and they would resist.
Right. Right. If he's one of these zealots, they're worried about when they come out to arrest him, they're going to have a fight on their hands. So they came prepared. And the mention of swords is important because they are weapons, and the Jews were not normally allowed to carry these weapons except in some official capacity sanctioned by the Romans. So they came out with swords and staves, and so normally they would have staves that they could beat people with, but they didn't have swords unless the Roman authorities authorized that. So they thought, these guys are going to create some problems, and so we better be prepared. So they brought out a better weaponry to take them on. The mention of staves is interesting because in the Talmud, which is a Pharisaic book, there is mention of criticism of the Sadducean leadership in this period. And what were the Sadducees criticized for? Well, the criticism was they went about arresting objectionable people and then beating them with staves even before they had been tried. So, you know, if they arrested you, they'll get a few good licks in. And, you know, it's like, you know, people used to be on the beat in, you know, foot beats in Chicago, New York, and different places. And they carried a billy club. And sometimes when the drunken husband would create a little bit of a problem, they would work him over with the billy club before they took him home. But he would wake up and it'll be a little bit more bruised than when he started the day before. And they used the staves to enforce the things that they wanted done. So the Pharisees in the Talmud are recording a common lambasting the opposite group, the Sadducees, for how they administered the rule of law. They would beat people with these staves. So that was what they commonly used in dealing with the Jews and dealing with issues. And the fact that they came out with these staves is an indication that who sent them out. They came from the high priest. They came from the Sadducean side of the aisle. And they had these staves as part of that. All of this tends to support the point that we have the Sadducean leadership, the small Sanhedrin, charged with the responsibility of administration in Judea, and what other function did they have? What other function did they have besides enforcing the responsibility of the administration of Judea? There was one major thing that they had to do. Does anybody find that in your research? Remember, I said that the major function that the Romans required of them was that there would be peace. Yes.
I would think that they would have to have justifiable cause to go out and arrest somebody, and in order to charge him with disorder. And I think they're trying to set him up that way, and that's why they came out. And if something happened, they beat him and says, "Hey, say, look, see, this guy was a troublemaker. We knew it all along."
Right. They. If you look at, we'll look at this here shortly. If you look at the Sadducean leadership, the high priest and his administrative team, they knew about Jesus, and they saw Jesus as a threat. And they saw him becoming more and more of a threat. And their responsibility was to keep peace and to establish order. And if that broke down, there was an insurrection, there was an uprising among the people, then they were responsible. And they would be the ones that would be removed from office. And so the Romans, if there was a troublemaker who was fomenting rebellion and sedition, if they failed in their job to bring this to the attention of the Romans, they would pay for it with their lives. So they were in the habit of arresting zealots in this manner. The zealots were stirring up trouble, so they would arrest them and turn them over to the Romans because they didn't want an insurrection. And they looked at Christ as being somewhat like this. So Jesus sort of taunts them in regard to this function, basically saying, is this what you are about? Is that what you really think you're doing, coming out to arrest another zealot? You think I'm a zealot? Didn't you listen to what I had to say in the temple? You're unaware of this? It shows how little you really know of my mission and my purpose as in what I'm preaching and teaching here. So, let's go to John chapter 18, verse 12, and we'll look at the next event. John chapter 18, verse 12. So we have the little Sanhedrin that is worried about things getting out of hand, and Christ is presenting a problem for them. So they want to get rid of him. And we'll see more about this here shortly. John 18, chapter 12. It says, Then the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. And they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. So when Jesus is arrested, he is first interrogated by Annas, who is the father-in-law of Caiaphas. And doesn't that seem odd? If Caiaphas was high priest, why was Christ taken to Annas first? Why is he taken to Annas first? Anybody have a thought on that? Michelle.
Annas had been the high priest for a long time, and Caiaphas was new at the job, and they had to make sure that whatever they accused him of stuck, or the Romans would throw it back at them. So they went to Annas because they trusted him to know the law well enough to come with a conviction, whereas Caiaphas wasn't as experienced.
Okay. Maybe that's a possibility. But Annas had been the high priest at one time. Yes, Mr. Looper?
Well, there's another possibility. The Jews, their law, the high priest was high priest for life. So in their eyes, even though the Romans had substituted somebody else, Annas might have been the high priest that they looked to as the real high priest.
Okay. You were high priest. You know, it's like if you're president, you may no longer be in office, but they still call you Mr. President. And different offices, they'll address you that way. Mr. Schultz?
I think Caiaphas was bought off. And the reason they went to Annas is because he was looked upon like the godfather, the ringleader of all the political aspects of the temple, and they wanted to get his concurrence on this. And if they didn't get his concurrence, then they felt there'd be some infighting going on.
So why do you say he was bought off?
Well, because I think what had occurred is that the Romans had offered a certain amount of benefits if the people that were, or if Caiaphas cooperated with them, and it became a political appointment more than it did a religious appointment.
And it was political. So Annas, we see he took them to Annas, which to us, well, wait a minute, Caiaphas was the high priest. And what is the significance of the statement that Caiaphas was who was high priest that year? Is there significance to that? He was the high priest that year.
My first thought is they bought it and it changed every year, or could. It wasn't a permanent position and it had to be approved by the Roman government.
That's true. And as you look at what's taking place here with Annas and Caiaphas, it's a sad commentary on the state of the high priesthood. What do you know about the high priesthood? As you became high priest, who became the high priest? What when they were from back in the time of Leviticus, who did they choose to be the high priest? Mr. Corley? The sons of Aaron, right. The high priests were the sons of Aaron. And you had to be a descendant of Aaron in order to be the high priest. And when you became high priest, how long did that office last? It's for life. It's a lifetime office. But it was a totally independent office. Once you were in, you were high priest and you couldn't be removed. That was how it was supposed to work. But as, again, we're not going to go through all of this, but beginning in when the Greek influence came into Judea, what's called the Hellenistic period, they began to have contention between those individuals that were high priest, and they would seek support from this one or that one. And the high priesthood office during that time of Antiochus Epiphanes and after that became a political office. And so as long as you were pleasing to the powers that be, you remained in office. And they would sell each other out. It became a travesty. And that's the condition of the high priesthood in the time of the Romans. So the Romans saw how this worked, that high priests were appointed. It went to the highest bidder, and that's how they used it, whoever was going to serve their interest the most. Mr. Sappington?
Another important aspect about the fact that Caiaphas was the high priest is the timing of the year, or the year that Christ was actually crucified, because you can come back, and that's one of the proofs that we have found that it was 31 AD, was that that was the year that Caiaphas was the high priest.
Okay. So so the Romans followed this precedent of changing high priest, and they changed, and indeed they changed the high priest sometimes quite frequently. And this was how things worked in that time, which wasn't how God intended at all. Yes, sir.
And Annas was not only the father-in-law of Caiaphas, but he was the family head. He was a patriarch. And so he was like an advisor, even though he wasn't operating in that position at that particular time. They still wanted his approval, his kind of rubber stamp on what was going on.
He was kind of the godfather. So Annas and his descendants ruled as high priest for quite some time. And you have to realize that the business in the temple was the high priest's business. So Jesus Christ, when he went in and overturned the tables, you know, if you've ever heard, you're messing with my business, this isn't personal, this is business. And that was part of it, that Christ was upsetting a good thing. They're making a lot of money, and you're overturning tables and creating a fracas here. We can't have that, for you're hitting my pocketbook, and he's also stirring up the people. Something about Caiaphas is interesting. While the Romans were in the habit of changing high priest often, not always on a yearly basis, Caiaphas did manage to hold the priest high priesthood a total of 12 years. He wasn't high priest 12 years in succession. He served in two different terms, and he served as high priest more than any other figure during that time. And it shows he was a pretty adept politician. He was a pretty adept politician. The interesting thing is that the officers, they led him away to Annas first before he was taken to Caiaphas. Just because he was the father-in-law to Caiaphas wouldn't justify seeing Jesus first. Annas said, and Annas was really the power behind all of this. He had obviously instructed the officers when they went out, before you take him to my son-in-law, I want to see him first. They would have taken him to the high priest, but he said, when you arrest him, bring him here first. So he wanted to see what was going on. And in John chapter 18, verse 19, it says, the high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. But Jesus didn't say anything. He didn't say much. He said, hey, look, I taught openly in the temple. What are you asking me this for? Ask everybody else. They heard what I had to say. And so he would not answer him and clarify things for that. The high priest then spoke, asked Jesus and his disciples and his doctrine. And the one who's asking this question, it doesn't say there, but it was Annas. He was still before Annas, not talking about Caiaphas. So it called him the high priest here. The high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples. And again, like we said, if you were high priest, you were high priest for life. That's how they looked at you. You were always seen as the high priest. So they would still address you as the high priest. So anyway, that's how they looked at him, and they addressed him as the high priest with courtesy. Now, let's go to chapter 18, verse 13, see if we can understand this. John chapter 18, verse 13. It says, and they led him away to Annas first, and he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest. And verse 14, now it was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. That's a parenthetical thought. A parenthetical thought that that one man advised the Jews that that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. This is a repetition of an earlier statement by Caiaphas. So what's the significance of this statement? It was expedient that one man should die for the people. Why say that?
Well, he had really no idea the full meaning of what he was saying. One man should die for the people was Christ's death from the foundation of the earth. He just saw it in their local terms that it would benefit the temporary government and keep the Romans off their back, but it really was deeply significant, the real purpose of Christ's death for all time.
So does anybody know why? And there was a reason he said that. Yes.
If you go back to John 12, I think it's John 12. I had it right here. Yeah, or John 11, I should say. But it was talking about the when Christ had resurrected Lazarus, the fame of that just went out everywhere, and people were looking to Jesus as a king, and they were expecting Jesus to actually come back and kick the Romans out, and that this was going to totally upset the apple cart. And so Caiaphas was saying, well, this one person dying to keep the peace and keep the tranquility the way it is better than the Romans coming and totally destroying, wiping us out.
So anybody have any other comment? Yes, Rich.
Again, they were trying to show that he was a zealot, and they've had problems with zealots, and therefore they figured they captured the king of the zealots, and therefore this one man should die for them since they got their leader, and put down an insurrection at that point in time by doing this. You know, you cut off the head and the snake, you know, sort of dies.
They were definitely worried about him. If you go back, as Mr. Sappington said, if you go to John 11, verse 45, it says, "Then many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him." That was a bad, bad sign. They did not want people believing in him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them things that Jesus did. So they ratted him out to the Pharisees about what he did. Then the chief priest and the Pharisees gathered counsel and said, "What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." So they knew that if this trend continued and Christ continued to perform miracles, that the people were going to rally behind him, and they're worried about losing their place and their nation. That means their position and their status as a Jewish nation. So they're quite worried about this, and Christ, and so Caiaphas speaks up there. Now, in verse 51, it says, "Now this he did not say on his own authority. Caiaphas said what he said for his own reasons, but he was not induced to say simply for his own reasons, but God was working through him." So there's a double meaning to what he's saying. "But being the high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad." So in other words, Caiaphas had a physical reason for making the statement. He meant it from a physical point of view about our losing our position and our being removed from office, but he was actually inspired. And it has a prophetic meaning, that there's a much wider application of this to that he would die for all people. And as you think about this, there were two. I asked the question, what called forth the comment from Caiaphas? So something's taken place that caused him to make this comment. And we have to go back further to find out what was the trigger for the statement. And there were two significant events that happened that precipitated Jesus' arrest. Does anybody know the two events that precipitated Jesus' arrest? What two events precipitated Jesus' arrest? Okay. As I said, there were two events that were important to precipitating the action of the chief priest. And let's go to John chapter 11 and look at verse 1. This is the first event. It says, "Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, and whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore the sisters sent to him, saying, 'Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick.' Then Jesus said, when Jesus said that, he said, 'This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it.'" So Lazarus is sick. They're worried about him dying. They send to Christ, and Christ said he's not going to die. You know, this isn't unto death. So John was familiar with these three people among his closest friends. He was friends with Jesus. And he was able to understand what Christ was up to. None of the people in Jesus' day fully understood what he was doing prior to his death. So all this is taking place. But the people involved don't see the big picture of what's unfolding. So let's skip down to verse 38. Chapter 11, verse 38. It says, "Then Jesus again, groaning in himself, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, 'Take away the stone.' Mary, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, 'Lord, by this time there is a stench.'" So that was why it was so important to wrap the body and put all of the fragrant oils and the aloe and everything around the body and wrap it up. He's beginning to stink, for he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God?" Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, "Father, thank you that you have heard me. And I know that you always hear me, but because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me." So he raises Lazarus from the dead. And verse 45 says, "Then many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him." So they saw the resurrection of Lazarus. I mean, look. The community knew he was dead. So here comes Christ. He resurrects Lazarus. How can you deny that that's a miracle? It's undeniable. This is not something that happens all the time. So it's a true miracle. People saw what he did. They believed and believed in him. And, you know, the question they began to ask was this: could this be the one? Could this be the one? Could this be the Messiah? And seeing such a dramatic miracle, it lent credence to the fact that Jesus was the Messiah. And as it says in verse 46, some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things that Jesus did. So they reported this to the chief priest. And then the chief priest and the Pharisees gathered a council. And this was the great Sanhedrin. And the whole body, we need to call the whole group together and look at what's taking place here. We need to address this and deal with this. And so you have the top leadership of the land, both Pharisee and Sadducees. And why should they care that he's doing miracles? Shouldn't they give God the glory? Isn't Jesus doing miracles something to rejoice in? Why wouldn't they rejoice in that? Isn't that a good thing? They didn't see it that way. Yes.
Again, it was a threat to their power.
Yes, it's a threat to power.
Which corrupted them totally.
Yeah, I mean, if all you have to do is look at any election, and how do people act when they want power? They would never lie, would they? They would never misrepresent their opponent. They never do things like that. They're all people of the highest integrity. Sad to say that's not true. It's a sad commentary. And these men were no different. They were in power. They wanted to retain the power. They did not want to give it up. And Christ was a threat. So the great Sanhedrin, calling the whole body together, not only the administrative body, the little Sanhedrin, but everybody was called together to address this. And they came to the conclusion, if we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him. And so as you think about what's going on here, in the minds of the people of Christ's time, what was the concept of the Messiah that popularly existed? What was the concept of the Messiah that popularly existed at that time?
To come back as the liberator, not the suffering Messiah.
He was not going to be a... They did not understand the idea of a suffering Messiah. They were looking for a military liberator against the Roman oppression. For instance, in Christ's time, how many of you know what Isaiah 53 is about? What is Isaiah 53 about? Isaiah 53 is, Mr. Cor- The suffering servant? He's a suffering servant. Came to lay down his life for many. All right? Now we understand that looking back in Isaiah 53, and we can see that. But in Christ's time, if you'd say, look in Isaiah 53 what it says. This is the Christ. It's obvious. But they didn't see that at all. And that concept would have gone completely over their heads. They wouldn't have seen that at all. They did not understand who the suffering servant was. Yes.
I think Palm Monday was an actual indication of that, because the people thought he was the conquering Messiah. They were out, hallelujah, praise the Lord, and all that type of thing. But when the time came to crucify and they saw that he was not what they had hoped he would be, then they turned against Christ.
Can you think of an incident? That's true. We'll get to that, hopefully. So can you think of an incident where Isaiah 53 is mentioned and addressed? Anybody think of a time when that Isaiah 53 was clarified? Yes.
Very clearly to the disciples during the Last Supper.
Well, no. He told them he was going to suffer and die. But you have to go to the book of Acts in order to find the explanation of Isaiah 53. Remember the Ethiopian eunuch was driving along. He's coming back from Jerusalem. He's on his way back to Ethiopia. And he's reading the book of Isaiah. And Philip shows up. And he takes Philip up into the chariot. He's reading Isaiah. And he doesn't have a clue who this is about. And Philip clarifies that it is a reference to the Messiah, to the Christ. But he didn't know that. He had no idea. And the people of Christ's time didn't have any idea about that either. So that was clarified by Philip. And like the eunuch says, who is the prophet talking about in this passage? And Philip clarifies that for him. So Isaiah 53 referring to the Messiah was not a common understanding in Jesus' day. We look back at it and it's very clear. But in their time they didn't see it. They were looking at a conquering Messiah. For instance, they did not go, you know, prior to Christ's coming. They didn't go to Psalm 22, which talks about the Messiah and his execution. And they didn't go to Psalm 23, which ties in with Chapter 22. The two are related. And they talk about the Messiah and his suffering. They had no understanding of that. And I asked, who did the Jewish leaders fear because of what was happening with these miracles and things? Who did they fear? They feared the Romans. This is going to get out of hand and we're going to lose our job. And because if there's an insurrection, they're going to come to me as high priest. They're going to visit me, Annas, me, Caiaphas, you that are part of the administrative team here, and we're all going down. So you know what? It's either us or him. One man needs to die for the people. So it says they will take away our place, our official position, and we'll all be bounced out of our office. And we need to stop this before it gets out of hand. And their concern for the nation. They knew that if things got out of hand and there's a rebellion, the Romans are going to come in and start cracking heads and killing people. I mean, the Romans were, they did not, any kind of rebellion, sedition, uprising, when that got out of hand, they marched the troops in and they took care of it forthwith. They we're knocking everybody down, we're killing a bunch of people, and they're going to stop this. And they did not hesitate. As you go back, you go forward in time to the time of the Jewish rebellion, you had hundreds of thousands of Jews that died in that time. And they cut down every tree they could find and crucified Jews that they captured. So they were making a point, don't do this. And They were very worried about losing their freedom. And this is their worry, that the people will believe on Jesus as the Messiah and people will rise up in insurrection against the Romans. And the Jewish leadership would be blamed for failing to take action. And when Caiaphas makes his statement, he's basically saying, what are you blabbering about? What are you so worried about? It's only a problem if we sit still and do nothing. It's obvious we have to act. It's obvious we have to take hold of this man. It's better that one man lose his life than the whole nation be roused to rebellion and many people lose their lives. So it's necessary that we arrest him. So they've made their conviction that this is necessary. And in chapter 11, verse 53, it says, Then from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. That was the only reasonable outcome. And then let's go to chapter 11, verse 55. We're not going to be able to get into the triumphant entry into the city, but we'll answer a couple of questions and we'll have to stop there. Maybe we'll make it. Let's see here. They ask a question beginning in chapter 11, verse 55. It says, "And the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went from the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then they sought Jesus and spoke among themselves as they stood in the temple, 'What do you think, that he will not come to the feast?'" So, what do you think? What is the question? What's the significance of this question? What do you think, that he will not come to the feast? What are they asking? Liz?
Do you think he'll reveal himself as Messiah at Passover?
Right. They were not asking, do you think he will observe the Passover? Do you think they're not asking, do you think you'll skip this one? This was not what they were asking. And what time of year was the Messiah supposed to reveal himself? He was to reveal himself at the Passover. That was their understanding. So even today in the Jewish ceremonial meal, what the Jews call Passover today, which is the night to be observed, the first day of unleavened bread, the Seder meal, there's a place set and a cup set for who? Does anybody know? For?
I think it's Elijah.
It's Elijah. There's a place set and cup for Elijah, a certain part of the service which is read that night, and at a certain point everything stops and somebody goes to the door and to see in case Elijah has appeared. The belief is that Elijah will come before the Messiah. Elijah will appear on Passover to announce the Messiah. And this is still perpetuated in Jewish belief. So what do you think, that he will not come to the feast? The meaning of the question is he planning to announce himself? Is he planning to declare his messiahship at the feast? That's the question. And they were acutely aware that he had been in the vicinity. He was in Bethany. Why not go out to Bethany and just arrest him? No, they wanted him to come to Jerusalem, and then they could arrest him. Now, both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a command that if anyone knew where he was, he should report it, that they might seize him. So they put out, people to find Christ. They were looking for him. They paid people to go out and then report it if they found him. So why did they expect Jesus to find lodging in Jerusalem? Why did they expect him to find lodging in Jerusalem? Well, they had plans. They made plans made to arrest him, and they put out the informers to find him. And why would he have to lodge in Jerusalem? I mean, Bethany was just a short distance away. Yes.
That's where the Passover,
right, right. They expected him to find lodging in Jerusalem because the Passover had to be eaten in Jerusalem. You couldn't eat it in Bethany. You had to eat it in Jerusalem. So he had to come to Jerusalem, had to come up to Jerusalem. So they expected he would move from Bethany to take up lodging in Jerusalem in order to fulfill the requirement for eating the Passover within the gates of Jerusalem. And they hoped to seize him at that time. And they hoped to seize him while everybody was eating the Passover. Why would they seize him while everybody was eating the Passover? Because then they could do it quietly. Everybody's eating the Passover. We arrest this guy. We're going to have less of a disturbance. So they sought to do it quietly when there would be no group, you know, throng of people around and create a disturbance. That this is bad enough, but look what happens next in John chapter 12. Then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. They made him a supper and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him. And go down to verse 9 in chapter 12. Now a great many of the Jews knew that he was there. And they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. People had heard all around the Jerusalem area that Lazarus had been raised from the dead, and they came out to Bethany because they wanted to see Christ, and they wanted to see this guy. This is the guy that he resurrected, and this is the guy who did it. And, Christ had acquired a certain amount of notoriety. Let's go to chapter 12, verse 19. It says, the Pharisees therefore said among themselves, you see that you are accomplishing nothing. Look, the world has gone after him. So everybody is jumping on this guy's bandwagon that he is the promised Messiah. So, they were becoming ever more firm in their desire to arrest him. Now, as you think about him coming into the city. Let's go to Christ coming into the city. Now, how did Christ come into the city? What did he tell his disciples to get so that he could ride into the city? Yes. Right. Jesus came into Jerusalem and was greeted by the crowds with the palm branches and the statement, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. King James Version says, Hosanna, blessed is the King of Israel that comes in the name of the Lord. Now, as Christ sends out his disciples, he tells them to find this, to get a donkey that had never been ridden on. And he deliberately rides into the city on the donkey. What's the significance of that?
My understanding is in ancient Israel, newly coronated kings would ride into town on a donkey.
Okay, that's... That does represent that he was a king, but he, as you think about it, let's think about this. As people are coming up to the Passover, or people entered the city of Jerusalem, do you think anybody ever entered the city of Jerusalem on a donkey? How often did that happen in Jerusalem? On a daily basis? Once a day? Once a week? Once a year? How often do you think that happened? It happened often. People rode into town all the time on horses and donkeys. They came in that way all the time. But if you think about Christ entering the city of Jerusalem, why was it significant that he rode in on a donkey? Part of it is alluded to by what Mr. Schultz said. Faith?
Is this already on? To my understanding is that it's a servile animal. The donkey was used as like a servant animal. Like the donkey was used to help in a servant manner.
Yeah, I mean he was a servant, yes. But yes, Bob.
Phil, It fulfills the prophecy of Zechariah 9:9 that he would come in on a...
It did fulfill the prophecy, but how could a pilgrim who came up to the Passover enter the city? Could you ride into the city? You couldn't. Not at Passover. You could all the other days, but you could not ride into the city on Passover. You had to walk in. Everybody was expected to walk in. So the fact that Christ enters the city riding on this donkey is indicative of what? That he's telling them who he is. He is the Christ. He is the Messiah. So you have this second, you have these two events. One is Lazarus, and the other is him coming into the city and being acclaimed as the Messiah. So what were they expecting him to be? They say to him, they say, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, the King of Israel. They're alluding to Isaiah 53, aren't they? That he's going to be the suffering servant? No, they're looking at him as the conquering. The conqueror, the liberator. He's coming in and the people are rallying around him, recognizing him as the Messiah. And so he comes into the city and he's clearly indicating that he is the Messiah. And when you came into the city, you couldn't ride in. You weren't supposed to ride in. You were to walk in. And he knew that. And he also had them gather up the donkey to ride in on because he was making a statement. Any other thoughts, questions, comments? Well, that gives you a little bit of information about the arrest of Jesus Christ. Hopefully it gives you some things to think about. Hopefully it's interesting to consider, and you can't always find, sometimes in other sources you can find different information that helps to fill it in and make it interesting. Hopefully you found it profitable, give you something to think about as we move on toward the Passover. So please have a great remainder of the Sabbath day.